I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education. I'm very happy to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I hope most of you are familiar with the program. If you're not, I invite you to visit the website. There will be 9 more lectures after tonight. We do 10 in the fall and 10 in the spring, so I invite you back. In fact, next week we will have the artist John Beach here. John Beach is based in Brooklyn. He's an incredible artist. He's represented by Peter Bloom in New York, so you can find some of his work there. Again, you can visit the website, and there's some information on him. One of the things that I find wildly interested is that in 2007, he collaborated with the playwright Edward Elby on a book, Obscure Reveal. I invite you to look into John's work and come back and join us next week. Tonight, we begin our series again with the artist Uta Barth. Uta is a longtime resident of L.A. She was born in Berlin and came to this country in her early teens. She taught for some time at UC Riverside and continues to do lectures throughout the U.S. and Europe. I have admired Uta's work for some time now. Her photographs absolutely hold me spellbound with their beauty and their mystique, notably favoring how we see over what we see. It is no surprise that this quality has won Uta an illustrious career with an international exhibition record that includes venues such as the Whitney, the Guggenheim, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Museum of Contemporary Art, and the Los Angeles County Museum in L.A., the Center for Curatorial Studies at Bard College, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, the Wexner Center, the Diepel Foundation in Amsterdam, and the Tate Modern in London, just to name a few. She has received 2 NEA fellowships, the 2004 Guggenheim and the 2008 Broad Art Foundation USA Artist Fellowship. In 2000, the Henry Art Gallery in Seattle had a survey exhibition of Uta's work that some of you may have seen, because then in 2001 it traveled to the CAM in Houston, so I hope some of you were able to see that work. She is currently working on a solo exhibition that will be opening this year, I think it is in May, at the Art Institute of Chicago, with some new exciting work, as well as the exhibition 1979-1982, also this year at Seas and Hoke, which is her gallery in Dusseldorf, and To Walk Without Destination, To See, Only to See, at her Stockholm gallery, Andrean Shepchenko. And then in New York, Uta's gallery is Tanya Bondeker, who was very kind in helping me to get her here tonight. There are 8 beautiful monographs of Uta's work published since 1995 to the present, 2 of which are signed and available in the Modern store. I hope you were able to see them tonight and pick one up. If not, they will still be available after the lecture, although the bookstore is not open directly after the lecture. You can come back and get that. Maybe next week when you come back for John Beach. The 2 that we have are Uta Barth, which is by Fiden Press, with an interview between Uta and Matthew Higgs, selections of Uta's own writings and essays by Pamela M. Lee and Jeremy Gilbert Roth. Most recently published, the absolutely stunning, kind of takes your breath away, be careful when you pick it up and you open it, book titled Uta Barth, The Long Now, a 383-page book with the most gorgeous color plates you've ever seen, and essays by Russell Ferguson, Holly Myers, and Jonathan Crary. And I'm quoting Jonathan Crary here too, in this introduction. In his essay, he says he's a bit of a scholar on perception, which is, of course, why he's writing about Uta's work. And in his essay, he says, "She, Uta, offers us both the immediacy and the otherness of a visual world that is beyond certainty and sameness, beyond opacity and or clarity." So tonight we are fortunate to have with us Uta Barth, who is here to talk about the work and ideas that have developed in her 20-year career. Please join me in welcoming Uta Barth.
Oh, the beginning of lectures is always the hard part. But I would like to begin by thanking Terry for inviting me, for hosting me, for taking care of me, for making all the arrangements for me, and for being an incredibly great person to spend time with in the little off hours that I've had between doing studio visits. I'd like to thank John for patiently figuring out all the technical issues that we had with the projection, which for my work is always very difficult because my work is so ephemeral and so hard to capture in reproduction that doing these kinds of lectures is a challenge for everybody and anybody, and it depends on what kind of projector you have. And John was just like unbelievably patient and skilled at solving all the problems, and now we have a really, really good, as good as it gets representation. I also want to thank the graduate students that I had the pleasure to meet with today. It was my pleasure. It was not my obligation. It was my pleasure. When I travel, I always like meeting with students. I like seeing what people are doing in different parts of the country. And I learn a lot from you, and I learn what I think myself when I'm asked to articulate it in relationship to your work. So thank you for having me in your studio, and I wish I could be here longer and see everybody, but the scheduling sort of didn't allow for that. Given that, I have a couple disclaimers that I have to start every lecture with. And I want to thank all of you for being here. I know this is like a weird weather time, and people are like skittish about being out, and I'm skittish about being able to get a flight out, and so thank you for coming. I'm hoping that I'll be able to fly home. And thank you for indulging the history of my work that I'm going to show you. I'm going to start very, very early on and go to the very present. One of the disclaimers that I always have to do about my work is that since my when I got out of graduate school, I had to do a lot of soul searching, and I came to the conclusion for myself that if I was interested in visual art, which is a very modernist idea, actually, people always write about me as a postmodern modernist, which probably fits. Or it's a very essentialist kind of idea. So I thought, like, if I'm interested in visual art, I should be interested in the visual. I'm not interested in narrative. I'm not interested in metaphor. I'm not interested in symbolism. I'm interested in visual perception. I'm interested in rendering the subtleties and the ephemeral and the things that we see that we don't see or don't notice. I'm interested in the phenomenology and the opticality of the world that we live in. And I'm interested in immersing myself in vision as a visceral experience of being in the moment and giving myself over to it as a way of being in the moment and a way of being in the world. My influences, I've taught for a very long time. I've taught for over 20 years, and I've taught photography. But my influences are not people like Edward Weston or Walker Evans or Lee Freeland or actually really anybody in the history of photography. I'm influenced by people like Robert Irwin, a little bit James Turrell. I'm interested in John Cage, who understands that in order to talk about silence, you need to bracket it with sound or action. I'm interested in Brian Eno, who's interested in peripheral sound, peripheral experience, peripheral, the idea of the peripheral, rather than, you know, the subject itself. And I'm this odd duck. When I'm in museum collections or when I'm doing a museum show, most of the time it'll be in the art department rather than the photography department, because the photography department doesn't care about what I do very much. The history of photography is full of a practice where the camera is used as a pointing device. You take your camera, you walk into the world, and you point it at something beautiful or something significant or something startling or a spectacle or whatever. But you are out there seeking a subject, and you're pointing your camera at something, and usually the subject and the content of the image are one and the same. In my work, that's not true. I'm not interested in the subject. In fact, I'm interested in what happens when you have no subject, or when the subject is air, or vacuum, or silence, or time. So the tropes that run through the work have to do with time, have to do with silence, have to do with visuality, have to do with immersion in the moment, and not with quote-unquote reading a work of art, which we're all taught to do, how to decipher something in terms of symbolism or metaphor or narrative and all of those things. My work is not to be approached to be seen in that way. It's made to be experienced, and in the process of making it to be experienced, it is very object-oriented work. So the images that we're going to show, which are as good as humanly possible, you have the best projector and the best projectionist I've seen yet, but actually seeing a work of mine, there's a lot of attention. A lot of the pieces are like three-dimensional. They're on like deep panels. The surface is perfectly matte, so you can't see any kind of reflection, and it becomes unclear. When you look at a matte surface, it's unclear where the surface is, so there's a sense of depth, or this illusion of depth, and so you're looking into the image instead of at this sort of shiny Kodak surface of photo paper. And I'm very, very, very invested in the objectness of the images and making them a perceptual experience the way that I experience the world. I photograph things that are, well, maybe we should start at this point. Please feel free to ask questions at any time. It's helpful to me, you know, maybe helpful to you. It's definitely helpful to me to know where we're going and we're on. Okay. We're having problems. Sorry. Why is this? Okay. This is an installation shot of the very first exhibition I ever had. I had no gallery. I was just out of graduate school, and I had a solo show at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And it was this emerging, you know, exhibition series. And the work that I was making at that time was involved in thinking about vision, thinking about opticality, thinking about after images and retinal kind of events, and thinking about being the subject of a photograph or as being the subject of vision, and seeing and rendering vision as invasive and almost hostile. Sorry, I'm having a hard time with this remote. I'll get used to it in a second. So these groupings of images are fairly large scale, and this was the sort of heydays of postmodernism. So the tropes that were in discourse were appropriation, and The Discourse of the Gays. The Discourse of the Gays, of course, interested me both as a woman and as an artist, as somebody who was talking about seeing and being seen and thinking about what it means to be seen and what it means to be seeing. But I wanted to break down the hierarchy between what was a photograph, what was a found image, an appropriated image, which most everything at that point was, what was a painting, what was a media image. So I made images. These configurations are made out of images that I made in my studio that I shot myself. The optical graphics are paintings that are like pure matte black to match the matte black of the photo paper. It's like really matte surfaces. I always use matte surfaces because they have the sense of depth, and you can't comb your hair in the reflection of it. It's like I never like that when people do that in museums of my work. And obviously all of the images in one way or another reference seeing and being seen. You know, in this case, the image on the far right is, you know, from the Buñuel film. And I tried to buy one from an ophthalmologist's office, and they wouldn't let me because of privacy rights. So that's actually my own eyeball that is held open by these retractors to be photographed. Interesting experience. But all of this work strings together an arbitrary set of images that are about vision and about light and about seeing and being seen. And they also begin the play with the idea of the after image, which I'm still engaged with 20 years later. So what would happen is you would look at these like painted graphics, and they would be so retinal. I don't know if you've ever looked at a real Bridget Riley painting, but you know they dance in the air, they vibrate, they move, and then whenever you look at a blank wall, you see the opposite of it. You see the absolute negative of it because of this retinal fatigue for the receptors of one color, so you see the opposite color. In this case, it was just in black and white, but like the black and white images would start vibrating and stuff like that, which is hard to render in a slide presentation, but I was interested in how you carried one image over to the next image, and I would construct these things in, you know, these non-linear kind of configurations and hope that people wouldn't think about narrative. Our natural human instinct is to always read narrative. We always want narrative. No matter how hard you fight against it as an artist, people want narrative. And I thought that by inserting these like optics and making these sort of strange or awkward configurations, I could undermine the idea of narrative. I'm not sure if that's ever entirely possible because people do what they want to do no matter what. But that was my thinking. That was in my intention, is to get rid of the narrative. And this, for example, is an image. When you look at the painting of the concentric circles, which just like vibrate and produce colors that don't exist, but are produced for your eye because your eye just can't focus on anything that like tightly, you know, painted. Then you looked at the next image, which is a magnifying glass. The first painted image would just like create an optical after image that would carry over onto the magnifying glass image, which then would carry over to the next thing, etc. And I was interested in rendering vision as invasive, as scrutiny, as blinding, as something visceral. You know, for me, I hate to be photographed, and I think it's because I'm a photographer. But it's to be photographed, somebody else suddenly owns the representation of who you think you are, and they can do whatever they want with them. And it's an incredibly powerful act. And even when I get approached by magazines that are doing reviews or articles that always want like an image of the artist, I resist at all cost because it's giving away so much power, because that image can then appear in so many other contexts and make so many other meanings that I have no control over. I can have control over who I am and how I live my life and how I speak to you and how I go through the day, but I can have no control over what somebody does with my image. And it's not vanity. It's just like a true, like, physical sense of invasion when I am being photographed. Not everybody shares that. I know people who love to be photographed. Okay, fast forward. Again, another image when you stare at the optical painting and then you stare at the image of me in the spotlight, you see this after image and they meld together, which is impossible, you know, to replicate on the screen here, but you can imagine or get some idea. This is a piece that is about 16 feet long, 10 feet high, and it is simply a film leader, that which precedes every piece of film that you'll ever see in a theater, but you don't see it. And I was interested in looking at and collecting the things that the visual kind of information that brackets narrative and storytelling and you know, a film. I'm interested in the curtain going up. I'm interested in the countdown leader for the film more than I'm interested in the film. I'm interested in that anticipation of a visual event and this waiting for something to start or this closure of something to end. I love end crawls. The end crawl is like the credits at the end. And, you know, it's like I talked to a friend of mine the other day and I was like, have you seen this film? It had the most incredible end crawl. And they were going like, are you insane? Like, what are you talking about? You know, like, aren't they all the same? And I said, like, no, I have a whole collection of them. And, you know, like, I tape them. And, you know, end crawls are really interesting because they're like this point of closure. And they have all these other kind of connotations. But so this is the countdown. And the end crawl comes at the end, as the name would imply. This is not forwarding. Having some technical difficulties here. Okay. Oops. We went a lot forward. Let's try to go back. What happened with that black and white body of work was that it was written about quite a bit, and it was written about almost exclusively in the terms and language and theory of the gaze, the feminist kind of deconstruction of women being represented, and the power of the male gaze. And as a woman at that period of history, I was interested in that discourse, but it was sort of like a sliver of what I was interested in. I was interested in many, many other things, and I was interested in things that were less cognitive and more experiential than just that. And so I had to figure out a way to get away from this sort of politicized, analytical, political statement and make work that was about vision, because I wanted to make work that really was truly about vision, about visual experience, visual engagement, visual beauty, visual, the love of the visual, or, you know, whatever. So the first move was to move to color. Black and white in those days was associated. We live in a different time now, but in those days, all newspapers were printed in black and white. So anything that was black and white had the tinge of the factual, the documentarian. Anything that was in color were like calendars and advertisements and things like that. So now newspapers are in color and it all shifts. But black and white was always the signifier of the authenticity of, you know, the document. And so I moved to color, minimal color. I chose yellow because it's actually the most difficult color to work with. And also maybe because it's also like, you know, sort of a color that refers to light. And I kept making these configurations of images, but the images became less about vision being invasive and more about visual pleasure. The idea of, if you're interested in vision, or if you start thinking about vision, vision is attracted by beauty. And in those days, beauty was a dirty word. I would go give a lecture, and the first question would always be like, oh, could you talk about beauty in your work? And that was a way of saying, like, you know, something very, very bad and hostile to me, because beauty was the dirty word. Beauty was completely, you know, on the outs and unallowable, and it was the frosting and decor and giving over to, you know, or not having the sort of rigor and integrity of this intellectual kind of deconstructive work that was being made. But vision is attracted to beauty. Vision follows beauty, and there are these weird kinds of things that happen when you start thinking about vision and your own visual experiences. Like, you know, you think about like okay, you go travel, you go to a new place, you drive through Arizona. The landscape looks fantastic. It looks just incredible, because you've never seen it before. And that is because the brain works very much like a motion detector. The brain has a map. Anything that it's seen before and seen repeatedly, like your own home, for example, which I photograph later on, it lays the map, and it doesn't really see it. It only sees what changes. But when we travel, everything changes. Everything is new. Everything has not been seen before. And so all these little neurons are firing in our brain, and I have a minor in neurobiology, so I can talk about this a little bit. And there's no, like, they can't find the distinction between the optical nerve and the brain, you know, right? So the eye and the brain are sort of like one and the same. So visual beauty, at this time when it was a dirty word, was what I went to. And then later, you know, a couple years later, I mean, it was in the air. It was, you know, it's not to say that I, like, sort of staked out this territory that nobody else would go to. Later on, like within a couple of years, Dave Hickey was writing about beauty, and Jeremy Gilbert Roth wrote Beauty and the Sublime. And you know, theorists started, you know, sort of doing the backlash to the really dire, sort of rigorous, didactic kind of postmodern deconstructive kind of work, and playing, you know, opening up towards the idea of the visual again, which obviously visual art has always dealt with the visual, or I think should deal with the visual. I think if you, I have no problem with, I look at politically motivated work, and I admire and respect the artist's intention in making it. But honestly, I have political convictions, and I act on them, and I act on them in a political venue, in a political arena, not in the art world, because the art world is not an effective place to produce political change or social change. The art world is like preaching to the choir when you're dealing with political ideas. So when I have, you know, when my own political convictions are being challenged, I go into the world that they're being enacted in, and I, you know, intervene in that way and not in my own work, because I think it's not an efficient medium for that. I act as an activist, political activist, rather than as an artist who makes political work. No disrespect to artists who make political work, but I just don't think it's the most efficient way to address those things. There's been lots and lots of talk about my work being out of focus. I always say, like, my work is perfectly in focus. It's focused on a plane that is not occupied by anything, and what you're seeing is the background of where it's in focus. And people talk a lot about making this big shift from this sort of multi-panel work, which is a little bit, has a sort of, like, still to me has this, like, didactic sting to it that I wanted to get rid of, to moving to making these completely out-of-focus images. But the out-of-focus images actually start in this early work. Like, for example, this, like, field of, like, daisies and butterflies in the bottom right, you know, is out of focus. It's shot out of focus, out of a magazine. And so the quote-unquote out-of-focusness occurs much earlier than people give credit to. The image of the curtain, I had a Terry was saying that I had a retrospective at the Henry, and at the Henry we had 8 rooms for each body of work, and having a retrospective is a really enlightening and a really traumatic thing. You, first of all, you know, I have slides of all my work and I see it all the time, and but still, walking through it room by room, I saw these things. I saw that, first of all, every body of work had a curtain in it. So the curtain is this, like, iconography that, like, just carries on throughout everything that I do, including, like, the most recent thing that I'm doing for the Chicago Art Institute. And you also see, and I could also see in every room which piece was the taking off point for the next body of work. It became really clear. I could look around the room and I say, like, that piece was the beginning of this other idea that was a separate body of work. I've never made single images. I just make bodies of work. I make projects. I can't figure out what to do with single images. So it, you know, in this thing of, like, seeing your own retrospective, you could really see, like, how you got from one place to the next, which at the time of doing it, I had not a clue about. But walking through the museum, it was just like here, 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 and here, which is a nice and nice opportunity to see your work that way. This is probably the most, sometimes I call it viewer hostile. It's not meant to be hostile, but viewer challenging piece that I've made. It's 4 panels that are 4 by 4 feet square, really, really, really tight black and white lines painted on matte paint. I almost went blind making it. And what happened with the work is that, much like a Bridget Rylett painting, the images would just, they would just flicker, and they would make these optical patterns that are very much like Oriental carpet painting, carpet weaving. They generated, even though it was black and white, they did, the opticality of the work generated color and generated pattern. And in the very center was this little thing that you couldn't see what it was, but of course you're curious, right? So, like, you want to go up and you want to go see what it is. And the closer you got to it, the more optical the line patterns would become, and the more hard it would become for you to focus and see.